Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Seth Meyers here. 2018 finally is over, but before we head into 2019, our staffers Sal Gentile and Henry Melcher are going to give us one final wrap-up looking back at the last 12 months in politics. Also, be on the lookout for their new political segment on the Late Night podcast starting next year. Without further ado, here are Sal and Henry looking back at 2018.
Hey, Sal.
Hey, Henry.
We are recording this December 14th, and we are going to take a look back at 2018. But we're going to look back at 2018 kind of through how our show has processed a truly wild year through Closer Look, which you write, and through some of the interviews we had with political guests, with journalists, politicians.
Which you produce.
Yeah, and we're just going to kind of see how our show reacted to some of the biggest stories of the year, and also stories that were just huge at the time and then had been entirely forgotten since then.
Yeah. It's interesting because until I started looking back at all the stuff we had done this year, I thought it'd been pretty normal year. Like everything been super normal. And we have a very normal president.
I will say we've been looking through a list of some of the major stories of 2018. There have been so many things that happened this year. I genuinely 100% forgot the Olympics happened.
Yeah.
I don't
yeah.
remember a moment from the Olympics. I assume there was ice skating.
The only thing I remember now is that Mike Pence furiously lectured everybody in the media in particular on the treatment of North Korea and specifically their cheerleading squad. And then like a month later, Donald Trump was desperately trying to get Kim Jong-un to meet with him.
Yeah.
And then,
of course, the summit was another.
And the summit's another thing totally forgotten that that even happened.
Yeah. At one point this year, Trump said, I love Kim Jong-un, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Something like that. Just, yeah. It's hard also to like remember specific quotes of his because his syntax is not normal human syntax.
Right. You have to reverse engineer how a sentence would not work.
Exactly. You have to try to go back and be, you would take a, it's like writing for like Bizarro Superman,
like
how
Pig
all
Latin
his words
or,
are backwards. Yeah. It's like you have to take what Superman would say and then say it backwards. I also forgot when I was going back through the list of things that happened. Do you remember the Easter egg roll?
100% no.
That Trump hosted an Easter egg roll for children at the White House and then went on a bizarre extended rant.
Like I do.
Like he had just overdosed on Sudafed or something about the military and how he's making the military stronger to an audience of children and their families just talking about how the military is the strongest it's ever been. And then later he's like signing stuff for them and then he starts talking about like DACA in front of the children. I totally forgot about that. And the Easter Bunny, the most hilarious thing about it is the Easter Bunny standing next to him.
The image of the Easter Bunny.
And they managed to pick the perfect Easter Bunny costume for this because it was like this gaping, like confused Easter Bunny.
Couldn't believe what was going on around
it. Somehow they picked the one Easter Bunny costume that looked like a Easter Bunny who was like dropped in the middle of Times Square and didn't know where he was.
Like, and you know that like Trump has tried to reverse every single thing Obama has done. And you know that even for the Easter egg roll, he was like, we're not using the typical bunny costume,
okay? Yeah.
like, I don't want to use the Obama Easter egg bunny. And then, like, some random staffer had to go and, like, to Party City. And it's like, we need a giant.
I want an Easter bunny that looks like he had a hood thrown over his head, was thrown into a van, brought to the White House, doesn't know where he is, confused by all the bright lights.
Yeah. And that's what they got.
Yeah. Very fitting Easter bunny for the Trump era, because that's how we all feel.
Yeah. We were all that Easter bunny.
Yes, we were.
Wow.
In the same way that, and this is something hopefully we'll talk about at some point, in the same way that we all projected ourselves onto another member of the Trump administration who is now leaving, John Kelly.
So a pet peeve of mine over 2018 has been the amount of stories about John Kelly possibly leaving the White House.
Right.
All year, and I have proof of this, we've been talking about his imminent departure, which now it seems like he is leaving, but also he literally may not be because they don't have anyone to replace him. But I do just want to give you a taste of the amount of times we heard John Kelly was about to leave the White House. Right. January 22nd, Vanity Fair. Are Trump and Kelly heading for a divorce? Donald Trump's relationship with John Kelly, his chief of staff, fraught from the beginning, may finally have gone past the point of no return. February 13th, Esquire. John Kelly seems not long for this White House. March 15th, CBS News. White House shakeup. Chief of Staff John Kelly might also be on the way out, sources say. June 29th, Wall Street Journal. President Donald Trump is consulting with advisors about whom he should tap as his next chief of staff, with John Kelly expected to depart the administration as early as this summer, possibly sooner, according to people familiar with the matter. July 31st, NBC News. John Kelly to stay on as Trump's chief of staff through 2020, source says. So different sources on those articles. October 10th, Business Insider. Trump has reportedly tried to fire John Kelly, but fails because he usually uses Kelly to fire people. The officials seem to suggest Trump has actually attempted to fire Kelly, but the retired Marine general reportedly just ignored him. November 13th, Wall Street Journal. Trump weighs replacing chief of staff John Kelly in White House shakeup. There's the word again, White House shakeup. December 9th. CNN, here it is. Trump announces John Kelly is leaving. But wait. It's 2 days later, December 11th, also CNN. Kelly to remain as White House chief of staff through January 2nd or longer, official says. So we're going to be back here in a year about how it's still imminent.
Yeah.
He's still planning to leave.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny that you can just ignore Trump and then that's probably, and then it's kind of like the same story with Gary Cohn taking the piece of paper off of his,
desk.
It's like he has no object permanence. So if you take a piece of paper away from him, he'll just forget that it was there.
And 100%.
Then, and then similarly, like John Kelly, Trump can just finally, and you know Trump because he hates firing people, which is part of the reason why this dragged on for an entire year, because he loves to call up his friends and complain to them about stuff that he's like mad about, but then also doesn't want to actually do anything about it because he's too scared. So you get this weird thing of him constantly calling up people who then call reporters to say that Trump told me he wants to fire John Kelly because he's mad at him. But simultaneously, Trump doesn't want to fire John Kelly.
Yeah.
So you know
also, John Kelly is the firer in many of these cases, we assume.
Yeah.
So you can't fire the firer.
Yeah. So you know that for an entire year, Trump has been like in his bathroom, looking in the mirror, psyching himself up like, this is finally the day you're going to do it. You're going to fire John Kelly. And then he gets up the courage and he goes into John Kelly's office. And then he goes in there and he's like, John, you're fired. And then John Kelly's just like,
nah, I'm not.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
He's like, okay. And then, of course, the way this was announced was just Trump walking to Marine One.
I think
on the lawn of the White House. Like, yeah, Kelly's gone.
Yeah. Somebody just asked him a question.
I will say this about John Kelly. He has been described as the grown-up, was one of these grown-ups in the room. Tillerson was supposedly this grown-up.
Yeah.
2018 story, bye-bye, Tillerson.
Yeah, right.
John Kelly was behind the child separation policy.
Yeah.
So for all these people saying, you know, he stopped all these Trump from doing all these terrible things, he defended separating children from their parents.
Yeah.
So I do not think we need to weep for John Kelly about this tough role he had and how he was this serious adult stopping Trump from his worst impulses. I cannot think of a worse impulse than separating children from their parents, and John Kelly was behind it 100% of the way.
We made this point in A Closer Look, which is that everybody projected onto him because there were photographs of him like with his head in his hands or whatever. But the only thing that John Kelly was ever upset with Trump about is that he didn't do things according to the plan that he had. But he enabled and was supportive of everything Donald Trump wanted to do. They were in total ideological agreement.
Yeah.
John Kelly agrees with everything that Donald Trump wants to do, and he wants to implement Donald Trump's agenda. I mean, and he did. Yeah, and he did.
And it was implemented.
Yes, that happened, and he was chiefly complicit in it. I mean, there's that haunting quote of his saying the children will be put in foster care or whatever.
Yeah.
The reason he took the job of chief of staff was to make sure that Donald Trump's policies were implemented. He was not somebody who disagreed with Donald Trump. He was not somebody who was rescuing the country from Donald Trump. All he wanted to do was theoretically impose more order so that Donald Trump could achieve his ideological objectives. And even then, the idea that he was going to impose order on this White House is absurd because you can't change Donald Trump. It all
comes it's like trying to cut water.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. and whatever, that quote of or whatever is just so heinous and entirely undercuts what Secretary Nielsen, Trump, Pence, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, they were all saying that, yes, we are separating families, but we're treating these children in humane ways.
Yeah.
And that was just a lie from the outset and continues to be. And we're seeing the tragic, tragic effects
of
that.
Well, that's a story of the year, which is that they repeatedly changed their story on the family separation policy. Mm-hmm. They initially insisted there literally was no family separation policy, repeatedly said there was no family separation policy. And then they said Obama had the exact same policy. Then they said we can't change it. Only Congress can.
Blame it on the Democrats.
Yeah, blame it on the Democrats. Then they just signed an executive order saying, okay, we've changed it now.
Right.
And the story of John Kelly, I feel like, is very much, in many ways, representative of the story of 18, which is in a couple ways. First of all, this idea of all the headlines you just read, which is that like there's this bizarre disorienting feeling of Trump that like things constantly change and yet they also feel the same. Mm-hmm. Like, because he is so deeply disoriented and throws so much at you. So every month, there are sources around him repeating all of the things that he says about like he wants to fire John Kelly and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And yet none of it actually happens. The story of John Kelly is very much that things both change a lot and also have this weird disorienting feeling of not changing at all. And also this weird yearning on the part of the media to feel as though there are people both within the Trump administration and within the Republican Party outside the Trump administration who don't agree with Donald Trump, mm-hmm. who are trying to constrain him or hold him back. And what we've learned specifically with John Kelly and the Republican Party more broadly is they agree with Donald Trump. The Republican Party is the party of Donald Trump. They want to achieve his objectives. You can see that just in the last week with the reaction to the Cohen raid.
Yeah.
The party that repeatedly proclaimed us a nation of laws when they were talking about immigrants and the family separation mm-hmm. policy in particular, for example. We have to follow laws. We have to enforce the laws.
All we're doing is enforcing the laws. Yes. We need law and order.
And again, this is a point we made in a closer look last week. Orrin Hatch literally saying, I don't care, when mm-hmm. asked if the president of the United States had committed a crime.
Okay.
And so that just – the John Kelly story is very much the story of 2018, which is that the Republican Party and the people around Trump very much agree with him.
Yeah.
And it is his party.
Let's talk about another White House staffer, Stephen Miller, yes. White House senior advisor, who, I don't know, by the time we're listening to this, maybe he's chief of staff or Secretary of State. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
This was the first closer look of January 2018.
Yes.
He went on Jake Tapper's show, State of the Union, and had truly one of the most surreal and insane White House interviews of 2018, of the Trump era, I would argue.
Mm-hmm.
First, let's play part of that interview, and then which rolls nicely into the closer look. First closer look of 2018.
That's right.
Trump, of course, not only defers all major policymaking to his staff and Republicans in Congress, he's also so fragile and erratic that he needs those same people to go on TV and lavish praise on him, as senior policy advisor Stephen Miller did on Sunday in this now infamous interview with CNN anchor Jake Tapper.
The reality is the president is a political genius who won against a field of 17 incredibly talented people,
mm-hmm.
who took down the Bush dynasty, who took down the Clinton dynasty. All these so-called political geniuses in Washington, whether it be at the big lobbying firms or
the only
many
person
of the
who's called himself a genius
Congress,
in the last week is the president, but the,
which because happens to be a true statement.
Okay,
a self-made billionaire who revolutionized reality TV and who has
sure
changed the course of our politics.
He's watching and he's happy that you said that.
I would be with the president on a campaign plane with a rally in 20 minutes, and he would be
you've
able.
You've already
to
made
come
this
up,
point, Stephen.
He'd be able to come up with material.
Yeah,
in
you've
the
already
blink
made.
The, of an
you've
eye,
already made. You've already that, said that.
A self-made billionaire revolutionized reality TV and tapped into something magical that's happening in the hearts of this country.
Ugh. I'd say Stephen Miller has a boner, but he already is one. Seriously, he looks like someone slapped a couple of googly eyes on a penis. Seriously, is there anyone creepier than Stephen Miller? He wasn't born, he just appeared after someone read an Edgar Allan Poe story into a cracked mirror.
One of my favorite moments of what Stephen Miller said to Jake Tapper is that he can come up with material in 20 minutes like he's a stand-up comedian, like, oh, going yeah. town to town.
Well, of course, it's easy for Donald Trump to come up with material in 20 minutes because he just rambles off the top of his head.
It comes up
with, like, 20 minutes would be, I would be shocked if it took 20 minutes for Donald Trump to come up with
anything
that he says. Yeah.
So shortly after that interview, Jake Tapper was on our show, and he talked about what that experience was like for him. So here's Jake talking to Seth about that.
Does it feel at some point a little bit like a rodeo and you're just trying to stay on top of the interview with that?
It was just so... Most of the time when people come and they want to represent their point of view, and I've interviewed President Trump, I've interviewed Rex Tillerson, we've interviewed lots of people. Most of the time when they want to get across their point of view, even if they think you're being unfair or they don't like the questions, there's an effort made to have a certain behavior like a human being.
Tapper had such thoughtful things to say about that interview and what the mm-hmm. experience was like of doing that. And most of our jokes were just that he looks like a penis.
it was a good pairing.
Yeah.
All right, so let's jump to April.
Yeah.
Which was the FBI raiding Michael Cohen's offices.
Yeah. It was around the beginning of the year that these stories about mm-hmm. Cohen and the hush payment to Stormy Daniels started percolating. And by April, there's already an FBI raid on Cohen's house, his hotel room, the many locations that Cohen has for some reason. He has like four different locations.
The offices were in Rockefeller Center, right?
Yes, that's right.
They were not far from here.
One of his law offices?
Yeah, one of his offices. It's actually right next to the late night offices. And we would just see Michael Cohen coming in and out.
Michael Cohen is the show's lawyer also.
Okay, look, we're not supposed to talk. We've been told we're not technically supposed to talk about it, but since you brought it up. Look, he's dogged in pursuing our interests.
That's right. That's
he will do anything to protect late
It's
night.
Like the Hannity explanation of his relationship to Cohen, where he's like, I would ask him for, not advice, I'd for real estate and law. And, I'm friends with, I know him. I know his family. I'm friends with his wife. He's fine. He's like,
fine. Yeah. But in April, we have a closer look about Michael Cohen. So let's hear about the FBI raid on Michael Cohen's offices.
Wow. So just to recap, the FBI, an organization Trump has attacked for months, raided the office of Michael Cohen, his longtime personal fixer, and seized tax documents, which he has repeatedly refused to release, related to campaign finance violations during the election involving Stormy Daniels, the porn star he allegedly had an affair with, on a referral from Robert Mueller, the special counsel in the Russia investigation. This is like the series finale of a TV show where they try to tie all the different plot lines together.
The first thing I like about that is the idea that we thought that was the series finale and it was in April. But it is this crazy, weird phenomenon with the Trump era, and it very much makes it feel like this sort of bizarre alternate reality TV show where all the characters keep intersecting.
Oh, yeah.
Like, somehow Stormy Daniels, the investigation into the hush payment to Stormy Daniels, which was made in October of 2016, came on a referral from Robert Mueller and the Russia investigation. It's crazy. Yeah. It is like that last episode of Seinfeld where they just bring in characters at the end to talk about all the bad stuff that you did. But so that was April 10th.
April 10th. So 2 days later, Ari Melber is on the show. He's a lawyer, MSNBC host. And right before the show tapes, the story breaks that Michael Cohen may plead the fifth regarding this case. And Seth asked Ari about that.
We got a little legal news I want to ask you about. So Stormy Daniels' lawyer said today and last week, Donald Trump said, look, you'll have to talk to my lawyer, Michael Cohen, about this payment. And today, Stormy Daniels' lawyer said Michael Cohen has basically said he's going to take the fifth when he's asked about anything to do with that payment. What does that mean both for Michael Cohen and what does that mean also for Donald Trump?
It's probably bad for Donald Trump.
So I think we can confidently say a few months later, it definitely was bad for Donald Trump.
Yeah, cut to today, Michael Cohen is now going to prison for 3 years.
Yes.
Is that right?
And directly implicated the president in federal court. And prosecutors said that Donald Trump committed a crime.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. And in our bizarre world, we just, like, the only defense Republicans have against it is not that it didn't happen, but that Trump paying hush money to cover up multiple affairs in the last month or so of a presidential campaign is not against the law. Their defense is actually to confess to what he did and to say, well, celebrities do it all the time.
Literally, Giuliani today
said, so what? It wasn't a big deal.
So when we get back from our winter hiatus in January, we are going to be in the midst of the 2020 campaign. Julian Castro launched his exploratory committee, and a lot of politicians are discussing their future plans with their families over Christmas, I'm sorry. If you're already hiring people and staffing people up, can't you just say at this point, I'm probably going to run, hang tight till January? Like, this idea of, like, we're discussing and we're, it's like.
Well, essentially, there's going to be literally, like, you know, there's going to be like 300 people running for president of the Democratic nomination. Yeah. So like the third tier people have to announce now.
In 2018, we had a lot of people through our show, a lot of politicians who are not running for president yet.
Yeah.
But are on our show.
But are not.
Not
actively, yes, discounting running for president.
And when asked about it, give those kind of coy answers.
And are talking to their families about it.
They're talking to their families. Yeah. Some of those people we had on the show, Eric Garcetti, mayor of L.A., Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker. But yeah, so one of the leading contenders for 2020 is Elizabeth Warren. And she was on before the midterms. And we talked to her about corporate money in politics. And Seth posed this question to her about if Democrats need to take a harder stance on money in politics. This was a discussion that was hammered out in the 2016 primary that, you know, Hillary is taking a lot of corporate money. And it seems like since then, more and more Democrats are rejecting corporate money, which I think is a great step. So here is Seth asking Elizabeth Warren if Democrats need to take a stronger stance on rejecting corporate money.
Money is obviously playing a huge role, yeah, in politics. And I feel as though the Democratic Party also has to answer for the large amounts of corporate money they've taken over the, yep, years. You don't take corporate PAC money. Nope. But do you think that the Democratic Party has to take a stronger stand against taking corporate money? Or is that just the price of doing business?
So, look, I've been worried for a very long time about the impact of money in Washington. You know, money just doesn't talk in Washington. It shouts, it screams, it commands. But let's never lose sight of the fact that the Trump administration is the most corrupt administration in our lifetime.
So I think she's definitely right, obviously, that the Trump administration is,
yes,
the most corrupt administration.
In fact, before we continue talking about that, just to underscore that, let's play a snippet of a closer look where we essentially, and this was a few months ago, try to recap all of the corruption scandals,
oh, great,
have gone on in the Trump administration so far.
Just to review, here's what we already know about the various crimes and corruption scandals swirling around the president. His campaign chairman was convicted on 8 counts of tax and bank fraud. His deputy campaign chairman admitted to embezzlement and money laundering. His personal lawyer admitted he conspired with the president to break federal election laws to pay hush money to cover up an affair. His national security advisor pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with the Russians. His foreign policy advisor also pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with the Russians. His first congressional backer was indicted for insider trading. His second congressional backer was indicted for wire fraud and campaign finance violations. A Republican lobbyist just pled guilty to steering illegal funds from a pro-Russian oligarch to Trump's inauguration. And Stephen Miller has been sleeping rent-free in the White House attic.
So clearly, Warren is correct.
And that was in September, by the way. We've added like 10 more things to that list since then. But yes, Elizabeth Warren was correct in her assessment.
An assessment that they're the most corrupt administration in our lifetimes and probably in American history. But also that, you know, Democrats do need to take a stronger stand on money. And it is interesting to see that I think that is resonating. Beto did not accept all this money and broke records for how much he raised. And I think it almost seems like this will not be maybe as much of an issue that's litigated in the upcoming primary, because, yeah, it seems like to take so much corporate PAC money is a liability now.
It seems like it's sort of like a baseline litmus test now.
Yeah,
like if you do, you're going to have to explain it to the Democratic primary,
right,
voters, like why you are. And it's going to be difficult to do that, especially because, as you just mentioned, it didn't stop Beto from raising like tons of money, like record amounts of money.
Yeah.
So it's not even really necessary. And I think people just eventually started to realize Bernie Sanders raised records amounts of money. Like eventually they started to realize that it doesn't matter if you can engage individual donors in the level that Beto does, for example.
Exactly. It will be a challenge, though, for the primary, because there will be so many people running,
yeah,
that it will be hard to get traction without money.
What's your legit over-under on how many people you think are going to actively run for president in the 2020 Democratic primary?
I think we're going to see a lot of exploratory committees.
Okay.
Right. I think we're going to see a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I think we're going to see...
What's the tiers? So we're going to see a lot of talking to families.
Then everyone's talking to families.
That's like the pyramid.
Talking
to their family.
I think 40 are talking to their families.
Okay. Oh, interesting. I would have said like 50 talking to their families. But yeah.
I would say 40, 50.
Yeah.
I think we see 30 exploratory committees.
So we got 10 families who are like, no.
Don't. Yeah, 10 families.
10 very real families.
Wait, 10 real. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're real.
Yes.
And they're not just looking at polling
really
and fundraising
happen.
Numbers,
yeah,
and opposition,
right,
research.
That's right.
No, they're talking to families.
Yeah. I talked to my wife fundraising numbers, and I talked to my son polling numbers.
Yeah, my son opposition research
yeah,
file.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, this is so stupid to speculate on this. I don't know. I think 25, 30 people will run. I also think a lot of people will announce, look at the field. I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah, we're
going to
get a lot of Scott Walkers, like people who announce and then like almost immediately quit the race. People don't even remember that Scott Walker ran for president.
Yeah, it's going to be the year of Tim Pawlenty.
Yes, that's right. Oh, man.
But yeah, it's going to be interesting, and it's going to probably start right when we're
back. I mean, and this brings us to November. Democrats are going to be looking at their historic margins in the midterms this year and be like, this is among the most vulnerable incumbent presidents
ever
in history. Not to say it's going to be easy to beat him. I don't want to be one of the people who's like, oh, Trump's going to be so easy to win. Like, we're in a polarized era where all presidential elections are going to be like sort of razor edge coin tosses.
Sure.
But even within that framework, he still is like deeply vulnerable. And a lot of Democrats are going to look at those results because they were historic.
I mean, so Democrats' margin of victory was the biggest in midterms history.
Yeah, that since they've been recording popular vote totals in the midterms.
Biggest margin. And the turnout was the highest in a century, in over a century, in over 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now when we talk about our politics, it feels like nothing, everything changes and nothing changes.
Yes.
There's 2018 was an example of that. There was crazy story after crazy story. And we end pretty much where it started, or pretty much how it expected. Democrats won the House, did not win the Senate. Trump is incredibly corrupt. We have more evidence of his corruption.
Yeah.
We knew that going in. But if you look back kind of before 2018, politics has changed a lot this year. We now have new political leaders that we didn't really know about or talk about just 2 years ago, which is pretty amazing. I think we can feel like, oh, it's politics is always the same players. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was a bartender last year when we were doing this. Now she's one of the most prominent Democrats in Congress and one of the most impactful Democrats in Congress. She's already changing how this new Congress will
act. She hasn't even taken office yet.
She's not a member of Congress.
She's already reoriented what the legislative priorities for the incoming Democratic House majority were. The Green New Deal is essentially a thing that she's almost single-handedly, with the help of tons of activists who are dedicated to this issue and showed up in the Capitol and were protesting, but she, through her energy and activism and her star power, has gotten other Democratic members of the incoming majority to sign on to, and now it's like a big legislative priority.
Exactly. Last year we talked about, we were really interested in this upstart campaign in Texas, Beto O'Rourke. He then went on to smash fundraising records and became really close to defeating Ted Cruz, and then some new poll, no one's even announced, some new poll has him leading the 2020 race. Yeah. Stacey Abrams was the minority leader in Georgia. She, this year, apparently was the most Googled politician, ran a remarkable campaign, will run again for office, we don't know what office, but really was this inspiring, remarkably talented politician who has clearly a huge future. She was on our show, and Seth asked about her strategy, which was that she's not going to try to get Trump voters in a red state. She's focused on turning out the base. Obviously, she came short, but a lot of that was because of these horrific voter suppression tactics. And when Seth asked her about her strategy, she had a very simple, great answer about that.
You have received national attention for your strategy in Georgia. You have made it clear that you are not trying to flip Trump voters or attract Republican votes. You are focusing on Democratic turnout and attracting new voters. What brought you to this strategy?
Math.
Math, okay.
I mean, look, I want every vote that I can get. But what I've seen happen for the last few years is that you've had candidates who pretend to be something they're not, trying to convince those who do not agree with them that somehow this time it's real. My approach is every Democratic voter we can get, especially those who don't think their voices matter, and independent thinkers who realize they are heading down the wrong path if they don't vote for a Democrat this time. And there are enough of us to win an election.
I mean, also that point that she made about being who you are and voters being able to sniff out when you're trying to pretend to be somebody that you're not is also very true, which is why authenticity matters so much in politics. And she was such a deeply authentic candidate, which was why she was so powerful and engaged so many constituencies that hadn't been engaged before because they saw somebody who represented their values in a way that a politician hadn't before. And if she had decided to go with a mealy-mouthed strategy of like pretending to be some sort of like centrist Democrat, those constituencies would not have been energized in the way that
they
were.
Also look at Andrew Gillum. This is a name that I did not know before 2018. Mayor of Tallahassee unexpectedly wins a primary, becomes this national star, and comes really close to winning governor's race in Florida on an extremely progressive, one of the most progressive platforms in America. So as much as our politics can feel frozen and feel like nothing changes, I think we saw in 2018 that the Democratic Party, at least on the left, has welcomed in these incredibly new, exciting politicians. And we don't know where we'll be in a year from now because we have seen the party refresh and bring in new voices in a really, really excellent way.
And that has energized the party. And in particular, the timing of that is very interesting because obviously they're going to be the House majority now, and they're trying to flex their muscle right away, both legislatively, the Green New Deal and so forth like that, and also in challenging Trump. And it's going to be fascinating to see how that dynamic plays out. We've already seen that just in the last week or so with the surreal Oval Office meeting with Nancy Pelosi very specifically telling Trump to his face, like, I bring with me the strength of the incoming Democratic House majority, which is, as you just mentioned, won a historic margin in the midterms
seats.
And is energized by all of these new faces in the party.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the one of the stories along with the emerging 2020 primary. The other big story of the next year and the ending of this year is the relationship with Trump and the House Democrats.
Right. So we did a live show on election night. And of course, we've talked about this before. On election night, it didn't feel like a blue wave. Obviously, in the days and weeks that came, it was very clear that that's what happened in historic numbers. And now we're heading into 2019 with the Democratic House, who has oversight power of subpoena. This is something you wrote a closer look on.
Yes.
Great.
Yes.
So let's put a closer look from, is this election night or the day after?
This is from a few days after. This is a closer look about specifically Trump's post-election press conference, where he's asked about what his relationship is going to be with Democrats in the House.
Great.
Are you offering an my way or highway scenario to the Democrats? You're saying that if they start investigating you, that you can play that game and investigate
better
them.
Better than them.
Can you compartmentalize
that? And I think I know more than they know.
No. No, you don't. Trump's like a Gotham City gangster who thinks he can outsmart Batman and ends up dangling from a gargoyle. Bad news, Batman. I also have a utility belt. Oh, son of a bitch! Oh, I'm upside down again. Oh, that backfired.
One of my favorite, just a side note, one of my favorite recurring themes in Closer Look is Trump as a really shitty Batman villain who would immediately get tripped up. But I love the idea that Trump thinks he can outsmart the Democrats. And that was seen yet again in the Oval Office meeting.
Right.
He went in thinking that he could, like, outsmart them, that if he got into a war of words with them. And you can see his thought process in real time in that meeting when Pelosi beats him to the punch and calls it the Trump shutdown. And then he turns to Schumer and he's like, I was going to call it the Pelosi shutdown. And then by the end of it, they bait him into literally, like, almost staring into the camera and saying, I am proud to shut down the government.
They got the clip. Yeah.
It's so funny, the idea that thinks he can outsmart people. But that is very much like the story of his entire life. He's always thought that he could outsmart people, whether it's like the feds or like the city council or the mayor or anybody or a real estate foe. Like, he's always thought he could outsmart people.
And he
believes
he proved himself by winning the president. He outsmarted everyone who said he couldn't.
Despite the fact that he lost by 3 million votes. But yes.
Sure.
Yeah,
right.
But he believes that. Right. Totally. And so it's amazing to watch him the day after Democrats win a historic margin in the House go, well, I know more than they do. I can outsmart them. If they try to impeach me, I'll try to impeach them.
Yeah. So the day after the election, we had Hallie Jackson on our show. She's NBC News chief White House correspondent. And Seth asks Hallie about what's going through his head now that Democrats have some newfound power in D.C.
The Democrats have taken back the House and they have this power of oversight. Do you think, obviously based on the press conference today, it struck me that this was a man who was a little stressed out. Is it likely that that's what's stressing him out?
Part of it, yeah. I think he's, listen, for the first time, he's now in Washington. He's inside the White House and he is facing a check on his power. That has not happened for him before. So I think he's in this mode where he's looking around, and that's what we're hearing from folks, and he's seeing, hey, now Democrats do control the House of Representatives. There will be an onslaught of subpoenas.
Onslaught of subpoenas, the story of 2019. That's what it's going to be.
Yeah. I like the idea that Trump thinks that he can just not get subpoenas if he just doesn't check his mailbox. If he never got it, he doesn't have to respond to the subpoena.
Yeah.
That is very much, look, there's any number of things. Forget, Democrats haven't even taken over the House yet, and prosecutors are already announcing, like, tons of other stuff they want to investigate. Like, the inaugural committee being investigated now.
Yeah.
Letitia James, the incoming Attorney General of New York, saying she wants to investigate Trump's business. Like, there are any number of things. It really is going to be a flurry of subpoenas. There's got to be a little bit in the back of his mind, just a whisper of a thought, that he must feel like he really is doing this. Because now he's just attracted the attention of every federal law enforcement agency in the country. Everybody is like, it wants to sink their teeth into every aspect of the Trump administration. And this is a guy who, like, didn't even keep paperwork, doesn't use email. Like, he doesn't have receipts for, oh, no, that real estate transaction was totally legal. Here, I can prove it. It's like he had some, like, mob lawyer go talk to the, like, sanitation department and, like, throw an envelope full of cash at him. Like, everything he did was suspicious and weird throughout his entire life. And now he's attracted the attention of the New York Attorney General, the Manhattan DA, like, the Southern District of New York, the Justice Department. Like, everyone's all over him. And there's got to be a part of him that's like, this was maybe
not a great idea. Maybe we can end here. I listened back to our review from last year, and we were recording on the eve of the Republican tax plan. This was the signature policy achievement of the Republican Party in the Trump era.
It was essentially their entire reason for existence.
Right.
They would justify the entire Republican Party justified their existence and their political power on getting this one thing done.
Which was, right, of course, to cut taxes primarily for those corporations and the wealthiest in this country. Yeah. And this was a big political win. This is a big political win for Trump and the Republican Party. That was not the story this year.
No.
This was something that Democrats ran on more than Republicans.
Yeah.
Republicans did not run on this, and it became something that Democrats were eager to talk about on the campaign trail and something that really resonated with people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They were just paying off their patrons. And in a way, it was almost, it's so telling that they didn't campaign on it because it just makes so clear how much of a cash grab it was. Like, it was just like raiding the till while you can because you know you're on your way out. So just trying to grab as many singles as possible from the cash register.
Yeah.
Because they didn't actually then go out and make the case for why this was a good thing. They
didn't run ads on it
as fast as they could while nobody was paying attention, and then try to hope people forgot about it.
Mm-hmm.
But as you just mentioned, Democrats very much did not forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the many reasons why Democrats won their historic margin.
The Democrats also ran on one of the Republicans' biggest failures, which was not being able to repeal Obamacare, and specifically trying to repeal protections for pre-existing conditions.
Yeah.
And Democrats running on the fact that their opponents wanted to strip people of pre-existing conditions coverage was one of the most resonant messages of the midterms.
And that will probably be another thing going forward in the next year, both as a litmus test in the 2020 Democratic primary and also as an actual legislative goal now that Democrats have the House, is Medicare for All.
Yeah.
That's essentially become like the key litmus test. Like, you have to back Medicare for All if you're going to run for president of the United States as a Democrat. And it's got to be one of the biggest priorities. Obviously, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made it a huge part of their campaigns and are a big part of their political agenda now. So that's going to be another huge theme going forward. But then again, as you just mentioned, we listened to our 2017 year in review. We have no idea what's going to happen.
We have truly no idea.
Yeah.
For as wild and as insane as 2018 has been, I mean, it's cliche to say it now, but I feel like I've lost my ability to be surprised that we're ending 2018 like more or less where I figured it would end up.
Yes. Yeah.
Democrats
it is
won the
very
House.
Weird.
Republicans kept the Senate.
Yes.
Trump's as corrupt as ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think there are new people. There are new political figures that we had not heard about. And also, back to our list of 87,000 people running for president, there will be people who run for president that we may love and get really excited about that we don't even know right now.
Yeah. They're going to do it like a lottery where if your number comes up, you are running for president of the United States.
Great.
It's just like everybody in the country has a decent chance at running for president of the
United
States.
It could be you, listener. So get that exploratory committee ready.
Start talking to your family over the holidays.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to Midterm Cram over the year. This is our final episode of Midterm Cram.
Yeah.
But we will be back in 2019 with a newly branded segment on the Late Night Podcast. We promise it will have as compelling a name as Midterm Cram.
We're forming an exploratory committee
to
right
come
now
up with a
to
name.
Come up with names, talking to our families, and we're hopeful that we'll be able to make an announcement sometime in the next few months.
Right. But in the meantime, please give us some space.
Yes.
Because we are going to be just over the holidays, just spending a lot of time, you know, weighing the pros and cons of every
talking
name.
To our lawyer, Michael Cohen.
Thank you for listening. We will see you next year.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Are you tired of dating assholes? Do you want a Prince Charming? If so, we're filming a reality show. Sign up here.
12 American women are flown over to the UK for a bachelor-style reality dating show.
There are so many questions about a show like this because it's so odd.
These women have been told that they were going to be dating the world's most eligible bachelor, Prince Harry.
What? Y'all playing with me, right?
You can binge The Bachelor of Buckingham Palace exclusively on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.